Hey gang, it's Brandon. Before we get to the episode, two quick announcements. First of all, you're going to hear from Philippe Rolla, who hosts the Hospitalist and Resuscitationist Conference. He'll tell you a little bit more about it. But he has been good enough to offer you guys, as listeners of the podcast, a discount code if you're interested in attending. It gives you 20% off the registration. If you want to go, and I really would consider it. It's in Montreal, which I realize may be a travel for some people, but an easy city to get to. And I really truly think it's the best critical care conference of the past several years. No reason to think this year will be any different, but just amazing, really high impact, useful clinical stuff. It is all directly applicable at the bedside. Just an awesome conference. If you're thinking of going, it's May 22nd and 23rd of this year, 2025, in Montreal. And if you use the discount code SCENARIOS2020, it'll give you 20% off. So really think of checking it out. There is a virtual option as well, and you'll get to see the lectures that way, although they have a bunch of in-person workshops, which would be a bummer to miss. Second thing, of course, as always, if you have not checked out our academy, the Intensive Care Academy over at icu101.com, you ought to. Tons of good content via video-based, self-paced lessons on topics not unlike this one. Great for everyone from beginning critical care clinicians all the way up through seasoned folks. We just got finished with our airway program. We've got a bunch more material coming out soon on POCUS. Lots of good stuff. So icu101.com, check it out. Otherwise, let's get to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Brian Bowling, and with me, as always, is Brandon Odo.
Hello.
So we're going to talk about one of our favorite things today, which is shock. And we're going to actually look at something a little bit different, kind of a different model of looking at the hemodynamics of shock. And we have our old friend, Philippe Rolla, with us today. Philippe actually was maybe our first guest, but definitely up there. He was way back on episode 4 of the podcast. If you're a longtime listener, you'll remember him. But Philippe runs the Thinking Critical Care site at thinkingcriticalcare.com and the hospital, what is it, hospital and intensive care?
Hospitalist and resuscitationist.
Hospitalist and resuscitationist conference in Montreal, which is coming up. And we'll link to that on the site because that's a great thing to head to if you're interested. But welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Philippe, you've been talking. The word has filtered out on social media and the various platforms about this kind of new model that you've been talking about and using for modeling, as in creating a model, not like model skin, shock through the various, you know, the various elements and interfaces that, you know, perfusion passes through in the body. And it seemed like a really interesting concept that I think would be of interest to people. So I thought we could just take this opportunity to kind of share your thinking, give people the rundown on how this works and, you know, to some extent why they should care. Because, of course, most of us already have some way or ways of thinking about shock and may feel like our brains are kind of not looking for any more ideas. But it seems like it makes a lot of sense and dovetails well with the things you've been working with in the past involving venous congestion. And I feel like a lot of the stages or elements of perfusion that are less discussed, and maybe this is a really kind of more precise, granular way to think about it. But give us the pitch. Give us the high-level view. What's the deal here?
So to be entirely honest, I don't think it's anything new. All these elements in one way or another have been looked at. And actually, so, you know, I'm going to reveal my true age. When I'm going to say that, you know, I was a resident in the 90s, sort of before the EBM, paradigm was out there. And, you know, my ICU attendings at the time were physiologists, but they were POCUS-less physiologists. You know, just by the nature of you know, scientific evolution, that we had no ultrasound machines back then. So they were very much like pressure-based, right? But they did. Like, you wouldn't rarely have found a competent intensivist in the 90s who would have been fluid bolusing, you know, a CVP of 10, 12, 14, irrespective of forward flow indices and all those things, which, you know, we had back on, you know, the Swans when you looked at stroke volume, cardiac output, et cetera. So I think it's a way, and then if we look at it a little bit historically, then you kind of had EBM that kind of crushed everything into this one size fits all kind of nonsense. And, you know, that generation kind of forgot about the use of physiology. It all became protocols and, well, this is what you do when it's weight-based, like, that makes much sense at all. And then at the same time, you had the parallel evolution of POCUS. So now I think we're in a pretty, you know, in the last decade at least, we've had the ability to look at, you know, both pressure monitoring, using POCUS to look at the physiology to determine why things are, you know, in such a state. And then I think if you tag on the pieces of, like, you know, and Glenn Hernandez needs a credit for this, of Andromeda, to bring cap refill back and try to, so the concept of the interfaces is what I think essentially, you know, I'm sure you guys already do it. You know, many people, anyone who at least I'll think is a, you know, a good resuscitationist, if you will, does this. They just don't necessarily do it in an structured fashion. And I think it's most important to teach to fellows and residents, like when you approach a patient, you know, how do you make sure that your whole circuit is working okay, and you're not just focused on one little part of the circuit. So we kind of isolated, you know, we put, you know, I put a lot of people in a pot and mixed it. And then, you know, the smart people came up with these interfaces, which are the important circulatory interfaces in relation to shock. There are more circulatory interfaces, you know, but I think these are the four that really relate to patients in shock when they go wrong. So, you know, an interface being like when you're going from one section of the circulation to another. So if we go through it quickly, you have your interface one, which is your LV to aorta to arterial tree. You have your interface two, which is your arteriolar to capillary, your interface three, your capillary to venous, and your interface four is your RV to PA, right ventricle to pulmonary arterial system. So those are kind of the four that we look at around. And if you look at what a lot of people do and a lot of people have, you know, have in the protocols of resuscitation, is really not even really looking at the coupling of interface one, but it's really looking at MAP, lactate, maybe cardiac output. So that's almost not even really looking at interfaces. It's just kind of looking at what's the pressure in that arterial tree. And I think the importance of looking at the different interfaces kind of tells you where's the weak link, where's the problems really happening. And you need to address that if you're going to have the whole thing working smoothly.
So we're starting with the basic idea that cardiovascular circulation is a circle, a big circuit. And like any circle, it has to connect all the way around. If you have a limitation somewhere, it affects the entire thing. And you've therefore broken down the kind of key points in the circuit so that we can focus on where that breakdown might occur. And I would think particularly to highlight the role of some of the ones that people may not think about as often. And it's interesting to hear that you've identified those points not by the anatomic element, but by the connection between two elements. It's all interfaces, not stages. For example, it's the LV to the large arteries, not the arteries themselves. And I would think that's because most of what you're focusing on is flow, which is about movement and gradients and transitions. And therefore, the issues usually arise at transition points. I mean, there's very little useful that you could say about, in that example, circulation by just looking at the aorta, because the aorta is not doing anything. But there is something happening as you connect the LV to the aorta. Is that a fair?
Absolutely. No, that's actually, you really nailed it on the head there. So when you think about people whose main focus of resuscitation is the MAP, you know, which is the pressure with some cyclical variations, if you look at them around that pressure in that vessel, that's a really very limited view of circulation. And I think that's where it is important to look at these interfaces. And that we brought in the, we integrate the concept of coupling, you know, which is something that comes from engineering, computer science, et cetera, where, you know, the two parts of the circulation on either side of that interface have to be functioning within a certain realm. If we take like your LV to arterial, if your pump ain't working and it's like way below its, you know, range, then obviously things are not going to go well. You're not going to be able to generate enough on the other end. If your arterial tone, your arterial elastance is so low, well, even if the pump is pumping well, you're not going to be generating enough pressure in that arterial tree in order to get things over across the next interface. So it's the coupling concept then doesn't just apply to ventricles and arteries, but it also applies to the coupling between the arterioles and the capillaries, which is the other thing that we really wanted to bring the focus here to tissue perfusion, because that is what it's all about. It's not about MAP, and there's a lot of, you know, realizing that MAP is not all created equal. If you have an MAP that's all by squeeze, you may be, you know, over squeezing and you're starting to uncouple interface two. Whereas your critical closing pressure, you know, is now very high, your flow is low down into your capillaries, and your cap refill time increases. You may be happy that your MAP is nice and up to 75, but if that's done with squeeze, your stroke volume is terrible, then you may not be getting much, you know, tissue perfusion.
So you may improve one interface at the cost of another.
Or I would say you're not even improving an interface. You're just improving that pressure, but it may come, you know, at a cost of worsening an interface.
Okay. So I can imagine this could be a useful model for research or for teaching, but it sounds like you intended this to be a clinically applicable tool. How are you, or at least do you imagine it being used clinically at the bedside?
So I'll tell you what I asked my, I mean, you know, if I see a patient, I may not start with interface one, but there's essentially no way I'm not going to look at all interfaces if I'm assessing a shock patient. And that can be really quick. You know, that can be a quick peek at, you know, my IVC. If it's, you know, collapsing with nice respiratory variation, I know I have an uncoupled interface three. I know interface four is probably okay, or at least adapted. If my cap refill time is good, I know my interface two is okay. And if I look at my EF and VTI, I know my interface one is reasonably okay, or, you know, any of those could be not okay if they're not. So, you know, I'll look at all those things every single time, and it's not that long. So I have my residents and fellows, if they're, you know, discussing a hemodynamic case, they have to have in their notes or their sort of presentation to me, how's interface one, two, three, and four? Otherwise, get back to the patient.
So you'll have people document the different interfaces and how they assess each one. Okay. Is that something that's understood outside of your unit?
Absolutely not.
but if it were, then it would be a useful common language. It just hasn't spread yet.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's going to take a long time to spread because, you know, it's more work. So
sure. And like you said, a lot of it is things that people may be already thinking about, but it's a more structured or systematic way to go about it and to make sure that you are hitting all those bases. Okay. Well, let's go through the different interfaces and talk about what it means to you, why it's important, and how you would assess it, and, you know, perhaps how you would intervene on it as well. Interface one is the LV to the aorta.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the obvious answer is that you're talking about cardiac output.
Sure, that's the best way to put it. But, you know, EF is going to give you a great index of your coupling. So if EF is really in a normal range, your coupling is okay. Doesn't mean your output is, though. So that's why it's important to have another way to check it. Like, if you're not in a unit, you don't have machines, you might look at the pulse pressure. And if my pulse pressure is okay and my cap refill time is okay, I'm pretty safe. or I can look at a VTI, or if I have a Swan in place that's giving me my stroke volume. Then, you know, there you go. But I do want for interface one, an element of coupling and an element of actual stroke volume. Now, it may be that someone has, you know, an EF of 30%, they're dilated and their EF looks terrible, but it's a chronic thing and their VTI is okay. That happens. Or it could be that an EF is like 80%, but my VTI is 10 because patients, you know, either dry or vasodilated with poor mean systemic filling pressure. So you'll still have to fix something there. Even though it's not strictly a coupling issue.
So it seems like, and maybe this is going to hold true for all the interfaces, in many cases, to really understand an interface, you would need to know something about the before piece, in this case, the heart or the LV, the after piece, in this case, the aorta or those large arteries, and then about how they're interacting or actually interfacing. And those all may be different pieces of data. So, for example, the arterial blood pressure or the MAP is saying something about kind of the downstream effect here. But what that means to the actual interface between them, you may not know. Maybe the blood pressure is very high. That may mean that you've uncoupled this interface a little bit and it's too high for the heart. Or maybe not. I don't know that yet without more data.
Yep, absolutely. You do have to look at the whole thing. Like, let's say you have a very adrenergic cardiogenic shock patient. You know, MAP might be okay, but the VTI and EF likely are not, and your cap refill time likely is not, and the patient's probably cold, you know?
All right, so then interface two is the arterioles into the capillaries?
Yeah, so that's the hardest one to do, and that's where, you know, I think in another decade we'll be really 100% focused on, you know, on the microcirculation. We'll have monitors that really will read our mean corpuscular flow rate, our capillary density. All those things are going to happen. They're already brewing, you know. They're just not really widely available because they're still too bulky and whatnot. But for sure, that's where we're headed. In the meantime, we really just have, you know, cap refill, your modeling score, you know, mental status, if that's something that can be, you know, well assessed. That's really your tissue perfusion monitoring, and we don't have it yet. Lactate isn't, you know, very good for that.
So if you have impairment of capillary or tissue perfusion, of course it could be caused by an upstream problem. So I may have, let's say, poor cap refill or poor urine output or mentation or some organ effect caused by a weak heart. Would you call that an interface two problem?
No, that's not there's a problem. It's not really at the interface, you know, but it's clearly there's a problem in tissue perfusion. But it's not necessarily an interface uncoupling. In this case, the interface probably just doing the best it can, unless, you know, the clinician has tried to fix the MAP problem by jacking up the vasoconstrictors, and now you've actually really truly uncoupled it.
So what it's starting to seem like is, because all this connects, a problem at one level may cause dysfunction everywhere downstream of it, but maybe the most useful thing is to find where it started, because that's the...
Exactly. So interface one and two tend to be tightly, you know, related, same as interface three and four. So it's unlikely you're going to have a real big problem at interface two if you don't have a problem at interface one. And same thing for three. Like, usually if you have an uncoupling or a problem at interface three, it's usually because interface four has begun to be uncoupled.
So it's definitely a little too simplistic to say, well, look at each interface, we'll find where the problem is, that will be abnormal, and everything else will be normal, because they all do relate. So it's more like you're finding kind of the epicenter of abnormality and pointing where the worst problem is.
The weakest link. That's where you have to focus your efforts.
And then if you fix that, you'll see, you know, how everything else is doing, and maybe there's another, you know, weak link that is weakest now.
Yeah. So let's say you have catastrophic RV failure, right? So your interface four is uncoupled. You know, you can look at that with TAPC, with whatever you may want. If you have a Swan, your stroke volumes drop, your right-sided pressures are high. That's going to eventually, if it's bad enough, it'll uncouple interface 3, interface 3 being your capillary venous. Now you're going to start to ding your actual tissue perfusion, right? Because we know that, you know, if you look at, you know, some of the studies are out there, if your CVP is anywhere more than 12 for sure, probably somewhere between 8 and 10, you're actually starting to ding your tissue perfusion, right? You're starting to have too much post-capillary venular pressure, too much mean systemic filling pressure on that end, or mean systemic venous pressure, and you're actually impairing your tissue perfusion. So your cap refill time can be elevated. There could be absolutely nothing wrong with 1 and 2. So if you're looking at that and you're like, oh, you know, my organ dysfunction, my MA, you know, like my MAP is wherever it is because now my LV is, you know, is not filling well enough and whatever, and I'm trying to help that with fluids, that's catastrophic. You know, you're going to worsen your septal shift, you're going to worsen your congestion. So that way you're always going to, if you're thinking of it as a true circulation, as you should, and assessing each part, you have to hit the major problem area.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, interface 2, how would you act upon it? Perhaps vasodilators, if you think that they're overly vasoconstricted?
Yeah, sometimes that may be it. I mean, or you might figure that, hey, this MAP was being held up by too much squeeze, you know, let's go inotrope instead if I needed that much, less vasopressor. If it's just, you know, the ones that we see sometimes, the cardiogenic shocks are very adrenergic. Sometimes, yeah, just a pure vasodilator will buy us some free cardiac output, free stroke volume, you know?
Okay. All right. Now, interface 3 is post-capillary, so capillaries to the venules. How are you assessing this?
So that's really vexus, femoral vein, you know, jugular, CVP. That's thinking about it as a post, you know, a tissue afterload, which is what the challenge is. So people have been so forward flow focused, the forward flowers, that, you know, they've only seen what CVP is worth in terms of a forward flow issue, which it isn't that great. But that's not what it's about. You know, CVP, vexus, this is tissue afterload, it's organ afterload. So that's the way you need to sort of reframe what you think about them and realize that if that's too high, if you've got that, you're actually impairing tissue perfusion.
Now, you can't actually assess the interface, right? You can say that there is venous congestion by whatever marker, but you can't prove that it's a limiting factor on the tissue perfusion, can you?
Well, it's been already done, you know? Like, there's a couple of nice studies where they looked at, Jan Inci was the one who was behind it in the microcirculation, but I think it was Villinga, who they had a nice thing where they looked at the tissue perfusion indices, and they could kind of dichotomize a CVP above 12 had worse, you know, than a CVP below 12. It isn't perfect, but we kind of know this. As soon as venous pressures become too elevated, there's a lot of, like, you know, sort of physiological studies about this. Your organ function starts to crump.
All right, so you can show it in a global general rule. It's hard to look at an individualized patient and say,
absolutely,
in the same way that you might be able to look at, you know, their cap refill, for instance, is poor. So maybe in this case, interface 2 is dysfunctional. You have to be more general and say that, you know, their vexus is poor or something like that. The CVP is very high. So there's a good chance, it's probable that, you know, venous congestion is limiting perfusion.
Correct. Like, for now, there isn't. Once the microcirculation tools are out there, then you'll be able to look at your, you know, your crepuscular flow velocities, your capillary densities, all those things will give you that picture. It's all been fairly well described by the microcirculation people. It's just not really available.
Right. We're lacking the tools to look at granularly what's happening in the capillaries. The same way we might look at the heart and look at the preload and the afterload and kind of manipulate them separately. We can't do that at the tissues yet. We can just sort of look more in general at the conditions and guess where the problem is.
We're looking at surrogates, you know, because that's, you know, there is that correlation, but we don't have, like, a nice number that my corpuscular flow velocities have dropped to 30. Let me do something and then see them climb back up to 40 or whatever. I'm just making up numbers here. But We don't have that yet, but it's coming. It's not far away. Like, you know, I'm in the process of getting, Glenn Hernandez has a device that he's been using for his research. I'm in the process of trying to get myself one to play with and correlate to, you know, CBPs, VEXs, et cetera. I think that's the future.
Okay. All right. So interface four is the, whatever, RV large veins into, okay, the RV into the PA.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned large veins. That was one that was considered as for an interface, you know. There was that, and then there was sort of pulmonary venous to left atrium, et cetera, et cetera. But we couldn't see a situation where the large veins to right atrium, you know, would bring more than interface three and four already. It would just kind of have to follow interface four. So, and then the more complex we made it, the less likely for any kind of, you know, useful, you know, uptake by clinicians there would be. So we try to trim it down. And the sort of left, you know, the pulmonary venous to left atrium has obviously a lot of, you know, issues with congestion and all that. That's a key one to look at when you're thinking, you know, pulmonary congestion versus, you know, is my white lung all inflamed, or is there an element of congestion? But for shock,
it's not a shock thing. It's a respiratory
It's not too
thing.
Much of a shock thing. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess this is mirrors interface one. Then we didn't look at the filling or the preload to the LV, and we're not likewise not looking at it for the RV. We're just kind of incorporating that into our assessment that focuses on the contractility and the afterload.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to kind of infer it from, you know, if you have a high EF, but a low VTI or low stroke volume, then, you know, you must be, you know, underfilling. But then again, the problem may just be an interface four problem, a crushed left ventricle. Who knows? So you do have to still go through them all.
So this interface is about, you know, failure or function of the RV. And I would imagine echo is a big tool here, or perhaps a PA catheter if you have that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think echo will give you the answers. I think PA catheter is if you're doing something to specifically treat it. You know, I'm thinking if you're working, you know, therapeutically to work on your PA pressures, to me, you should be monitoring your PA pressures, you know, for whatever pathology it may be. But echo will also do it.
So what would you say if I argued, because I can see the argument being made that because this is all so interdependent and, you know, it's like looking at any critically ill ICU patient. Usually, you know, there's 100 things that are technically abnormal about them, ranging from lab values to various studies or outright diagnoses. They have an AKI, they have AFib, their blood pressure is low, they're encephalopathic, whatever. And the way that we'll often find clarity is just by, I mean, yes, you treat or try to support individual things, but by you understand the patient by looking at what caused it all. And what if someone said, look, this is almost hyper-focusing on the individual effects of things because it's also connected. Can't I just determine the underlying etiology of the problem and focus on treating that? And that will tell me, if I was interested, at what point in the circulation the problem is arising from. So, for instance, you could say, well, this interface or that one, but the underlying problem is septic shock, which is a distributive form of shock, and that's what we'll focus on treating, and everything else is sort of secondary to that. Will that not get you most of the way there?
Sure. I mean, I would say that's your entry-level approach. And it's going to, you know, if you just do source control, if you kind of just throw a little bit of everything at a septic patient, I think there's, you know, you'll likely save, you know, whatever, 80% of the salvageable ones. I think when you want to really perform as excellent medicine as you can, then, you know, if this septic patient has developed some septic cardiomyopathy, you're going to need something else if they're going to survive, you know? If they've developed, you know, if it's a bad pneumonia that's now they've blown out their RV, you're going to need something specific that is not fluids or antibiotics or whatever until, you know, the source control kicks in and normal physiology returns or you recruit the lung or whatever. So I think that's sort of a, you know, that's cringy to me, you know? Like, I wouldn't want to have, you know, my fellow residents come back with, let's just, you know, do source control, you know, 20 mLs per kg to not offend me with the 30, and some Levo to just keep up their MAP at 65. I'd be like, that's okay until I show up and get a real look at the patient, you know?
Well, I guess the argument is that regardless of what the initial insult was, that's, you can still have a secondary problem that becomes important or even more important. Maybe that person who was in distributive shock and got 10 liters of fluid is now primarily having right heart failure or something like that. It just, whatever you started with doesn't have to be the only problem. And
exactly. Yeah. I think a lot of the times, you know, we're very multifactorial in what is, you know, is what's dinging our organ function. And, you know, I think, yeah, if you have someone who's not that sick, who's a little low blood pressure, you touch them, they're kind of warm. Sure. Their urosepsis. Sure. Give them a bit of fluid, a little antibiotics and a little bit of Levo, and they're probably going to be fine. But, you know, you get the really sick ones. I think, you know, personalized medicine is really the way to go.
Well, I guess part of what I'm thinking is that I could imagine you assess somebody and like four out of their five interfaces are abnormal or something. A temptation, and maybe the wrong one, would be to try to treat each of them through some individual tool. Whereas maybe the more correct approach is to start with what you think is the underlying problem, treat that as best you can, and then see what else is still a problem and kind of go sequentially because they're all so interrelated.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Like, I think, you know, like for anything else, this needs to be like sequentially done many times, maybe not every single element of it every single time. But, you know, you're starting, you know, an inotrope, then you're going to have to go back and look at your VTI or have your swan tell you what your stroke volume is, because I think that's pretty key.
I guess what I could also say as the argument is to help somebody organize in their mind. You know, it's almost like at this point we have too many methods or markers for assessing hemodynamics, ranging from various labs to various vitals, all kinds of ultrasound parameters. If you have a Swan, you have your cap refill. It's like every time you turn around, someone's got something new. So, and then someone's question may be like, well, which one do I use? And that's not really the right question. The question is, what is each of them telling you? And now you can sort of organize, well, this is an assessment of interface three and this and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what we really wanted. We're not trying to advocate for, well, you must, you know, use a PA catheter. You must use, I mean, I think it's hard to get around not using ultrasound. But, you know, let's say I have a patient on the ward, you know, what's my pulse pressure? Are they warm? Is their interface bad? If their pulse pressure is like they're hypotensive, you know, with a diastolic of 30 and they're warm, you know, I think they're, and I don't see their JVP, I've got essentially my four interfaces there. If I don't see their JVP, they're warm, their cap refill time is prolonged, their diastolic is 30, you know, I don't think they're uncoupled. I think they're uncoupled in the sense that your arterial elastance is too low. They need some, they need some squeeze because they have a lot of recruitable volume, but with a low CVP, they can probably at least for a certain time tolerate some volume. Yeah. You know, I don't think I need to jump on, hey, give me push a dose epi on this one, cause I have a wide pulse pressure and a low diastolic. So you can use any tool you'd like. Just make sure you have a peek at every one of those.
All right. And that's practically speaking, I would imagine that's one of the more actionable results of this, just calling to attention the less considered interfaces, because
exactly. Everybody
is going to, whatever, make sure the arterial blood pressure is not low. That's like, you don't have to tell them that. But maybe you have to remind them that while you're doing that, we should also make sure that there is not a microcirculatory problem or, you know, RV problem, things like that. And especially because only focusing on one problem, if it has the potential to harm other elements of the circulation, then it's a unbalanced view of things. Like, well, it's easy to treat shock. I just put them all on pressors and their blood pressure goes up. Okay. But what about...
Exactly.
It's like my, I just got my son a model train for Christmas, and every time I turn around, the little tracks are getting disconnected, and it's a big circle. So I'll go and I'll push them together, and then because it's a big circle, half the time when I do, it makes an opening somewhere else in the circle. So I'm not really sure how to fix it, but all I can do is find the worst of them, try to get that to stay together, and then, you know, kind of go from there.
That's a great analogy.
Brian, what do you think?
I think this is a really interesting approach. I really like what you said about, you know, we've kind of gotten away from physiology and we just tend to go through algorithms and stuff. And so I really like this approach in that it really is thinking, kind of thinking through the problem, not just if this, then that. It'd be interesting to see, like you said, when this new stuff comes around and becomes available to really assess, because I think you're right that interface two is the one that's really hard to kind of nail down.
And I could see how, like you said, which interfaces you define and look at is somewhat arbitrary. I mean, you can focus on different things. I mean, you intentionally, you know, didn't call out the great veins into the RV. Or, you know, what about the capillaries into like functionally delivering oxygen into the electron transport chain, like a cytotoxic problem. I mean, you could have problems at other points that would be relevant, but it's also supposed to be a practical tool. So you got to kind of pick what's.
That's a great one. We hadn't thought of that one, but that would be a great one to add. But you can imagine if you're going to try to, you know, quote unquote, sell this to anyone, that now you're up to like 9 interfaces. Or you just forget it. You know, I'm going back to mean arterial pressure.
Right. But it's, you know, it is bringing it back to physiology. So like, we all agree that the blood has to go in a big circle. And so it's obvious that you can't argue with that. Any point in that circle could be the problem. Now, you could say, practically speaking, it's more likely to be at certain points than others. But I don't know that it's even obvious which of those it is. It probably depends what kind of patient you're seeing. You know, if you're in the CCU, it's going to be a different point than on a medical unit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for this, we also kind of, you know, for the use of this model should be one where you've you know, fixed the massive physical problem. So yes, of course, if you have tamponade, it's going to have a poor VTI, you're going to be congested, this and that, but it's no point in tweaking those things if you haven't, you know, drained the effusion, or if you haven't relieved the tension pneumo, or if you haven't, you know, if you have a transected aorta, well, you know, so you do have to figure that this is a stable ish system, in the sense that this is what you have to play with, because obviously all reversible things should have been dealt with, you know? Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I could also see a pitfall being that people start to associate each problem with a one fix, and that's what they do. So just like guy who looks at the IVC and sees that it's small, so they give fluid and that's that. They say, well, you know, this interface, so I gave him an inotrope, and then that interface, so I gave him a pressor, and this interface, so I gave him a fluid, so we're all set. Whereas the underlying problem was that they're in tamponade or something.
Well, I think that's the constant challenge to medicine, right, is that everybody likes an algorithm. Right, it's easier.
Yeah.
And so if you can algorithmize, is that a word? Everything you will, right? Somebody will do it. Like you said, it'll become a if this then that instead of thinking.
Yeah, I don't see how it can connect. I mean, you can make it systematic and algorithmic for the assessment, but not really how you act on it. I don't see how that could be done. It's too complicated.
It would be like, you know, a wall full of arrows and things. It'd be insane. You know, so.
But well, I mean, you can make it so that your fellow, or I don't know, your nurses or whatever, can kind of fill data in on these points, so that you have all this useful data, depending on what tools you have available. Just like we look at, you know, whatever vital signs that have been charted.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
But I think you're right, though, Brandon. The temptation, somebody is going to try to make it. Well, if the problem is this, then this, right? You know, I mean, I tell my students all the time, turns out medicine's hard and you have to do some thinking once in a while. You can't just follow the algorithms.
Yeah, they're going to want the early goal-directed therapy of interface. Yeah. I mean, I guess kind of what it was originally, trying to,
Yeah, it was. I mean, obviously the therapeutics were trying to hit all the things, but without looking at any of them, just kind of like,
Like I said, do it all without seeing where the problem is. And the problem is that some of the things worse than other things, so it's not quite that simple. Like knowing that in a car you could hit the gas or the brake, so we're like, oh, we'll just cover all our bases and hit them both.
Well, I remember, Manny Rivers' study came out when I was a relatively new staff, and I remember thinking, whoa, we're going to be giving like dobutamine, and I have no idea what the cardiac function is. That seems like that makes no sense, you know?
Yeah. And especially when you're looking, like we've been talking about, a lot of these markers, they're not so specific that they call out any one exact parameter. Right, they're all influenced by each other. So I think it must take a pretty nuanced eye to look at all this data and decide where you go from there. Just like, you know, I'll skim the chart and say, yeah, this guy has an AKI and a fever and he's got a white counter or whatever. None of that really is like actionable to me. I'm going to go treat what's causing those things.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So I don't expect it to be popular at a wide scale. And we certainly expect it, which, you know, the paper is in review, but it, you know, it got some scalding reviews by people because it's, you know, that we kind of suggest that, you know, if your interface 3 or 4 are uncoupled, fluids is not the answer. And we had some people saying you're mentioning that you would not give fluids to a fluid responsive patient. We're like, oh boy, there's still so much to be done, because definitely we would not, you know, if they're intolerant and responsive, not giving fluids. And that's just, you know, so it's not going to be, I think it's going to be popular towards people who want to inherently personalize their treatment to patients and who like, you know, will either grow to like, or like physiologists. That's why I think hopefully it's a good teaching tool for people whose resuscitation knowledge and skills are growing. Hopefully it's for those who are already there. I think it's going to be a good, you know, way to teach their fellows and whatnot. And I think for those who don't like it, they're just going to retire not liking it, and so be it. It's all.
Sure. Until we have the master circulation camera that just puts in continuous like radionuclide tracers and shows at what point in your circulation it slows down. Like, oh, it's right there. It's in his toes. We'll just fix that.
yep. One day.
All right, Philippe. Any closing thoughts on this?
No, but you know, my shameless plug is if people want to learn about this from, you know, the people who do this stuff day in and day out, H&R is in Montreal, May 22nd and 23rd. And our focus this year is, you know, on congestion and on shock assessment. So it's, you know, it's called the Hospitalist and Resuscitationist because it is applicable to hospitalists, and they have their dedicated second day. And resuscitationist is, of course, kind of, you know, the core of what we started, but we really got some good people running the hospitalist side now. Katie Whisker from Vancouver, Gigi Liu from Hopkins. So it should be a lot of fun for both sides. And it's really a blast to exchange with everyone who come.
All right. Yeah. And we'll put a link to the conference in the show notes, because historically it's been sort of hard to find. There's no website. It's like on your blog.
Yeah. We're a mom and pop shop, you know, so.
But it's great. I mean, they've had a phenomenal conference in the recent years. I think it's best critical care conference of late as far as practical clinical stuff. So check
Thanks,
it out
guys.
If you haven't. But. All right, Philippe. Well, this has been fascinating. Hopefully it's triggered some, neuronal depolarizations out there. people can reach out to you if they have more questions. And you said you got a paper coming out on this?
Well, it's going to come out somewhere. hopefully. Well, you know, like, you know, the more academic people, you know, are hoping for high impact journals and stuff like that. But I think that's where we're going to run into a lot of, you know,
sure.
sort of mm-hmm. pillars of the community resisting these kind of, you know,
reviewer two can't be convinced.
Yeah, reviewer two stuff.
20 cc's per kilo.
Okay. Yeah. Personally, for me, I don't care, as long as it's something's PubMedable.
Yeah, it's all the same.
So it'll come out sometime, hopefully in the next month or two.
Okay, right on.
Cool.
Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Yeah, thanks for joining, as always.